Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey guys, welcome to another edition of Talking Metal. This is a best of edition, and I'm going to tell you what we're going to hear, what classic Talking Metal moment we're going to hear today in just a moment, so stay tuned for that. But before I do, let's talk about supporting the show. Go to talkingmetal.com and use our Amazon links to jump over to Amazon and then go about making your purchases. It's very important. We really appreciate you using those links. We really need you to use those links. Again, Amazon is the place to do all your online shopping, and it's just an additional step, just going to talkingmetal.com and linking on over to Amazon to make your purchases. You can like our Facebook page. There's a bunch of Facebook pages out there. There's the official Talking Metal Facebook page, which I run. Talking Metal Digital page is out there. And give that a like. Connect with us there, both of those pages. You can also write a review for us on iTunes. That's very helpful. Leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Subscribe to us on iTunes if you don't do that. Another thing you can do to support us is a simple PayPal donation. And my PayPal account is linked through talkingmetal.com. You can find it there. That's about it, you know. Go to talkingmetal.com, visit our site, and look at the pictures I put up in the show notes. And spread the word. Buy a t-shirt in the merch section on talkingmetal.com. So, having said that, this is, again, a best-of episode. We're going to go back all the way to 2007. And this interview was originally posted in episode 122 of Talking Metal. It's with Martin Popoff, and we talk about Black Sabbath. It was called the Black Sabbath Special, actually. So what I'm realizing is there's a lot of great interviews from Talking Metal history. You know, we've been on for 11 years this week. So there's just a shitload of content out there, and I feel like a lot of the old stuff is kind of hard to find. Even this Martin Popoff interview, I kept thinking, you know, Martin did a great interview with us where we spoke about Black Sabbath and some other stuff, and even for me, it took me a freaking 10 minutes to find the thing online. So having said that, occasionally, I'd like to go back and revisit some of the great stuff that we've done in the past, and that's what we're going to do here. This interview, again, was recorded in early 2007. It was originally published on TalkingMetal.com and iTunes in January 17th, 2007, and Martin came on to talk about his book that he wrote about Black Sabbath. Since then, he's published another book on Black Sabbath, which I actually read, and it's excellent. He actually gave me a special thanks in the beginning of it. And that book is Black Sabbath Fact, FAQ, All That's Left to Know on the First Name in Metal. Great, great read, Black Sabbath Fact. Check that out. And in the book he was promoting during this interview back in 2007 was Black Sabbath Doom Let Loose, which is another great book. He's also since written the Ozzy book, Steal Away the Night, which is a picture book. I bought it, haven't read it yet, and planning to do so shortly. But Martin Popoff is an incredibly knowledgeable guy when it comes to heavy metal. One of the most knowledgeable guys, in my opinion. And having said that, this interview is just a lot of fun to listen to, and I feel like you guys like listening to the historians. I just have gotten a lot of response on the interviews I've did with Greg Renoff, the Van Halen ones I've done with him. And this kind of reminded me of that. Martin and I just talk some Sabbath. Then we go in some other directions. You know, we talk about Martin's favorite 80s metal records. It's just a good listen. It's not exclusively about Sabbath, but mostly about Sabbath. And remember, this is before Dio died. This was recorded in 2007. Heaven and Hell had begun, and he was playing with Geezer and Iommi and Vinny Appice in the band Heaven and Hell. So we talk a little bit about that. And, you know, I don't think it feels dated, this interview, and I do believe it's a great listen. And I'm sure a lot of you listeners probably weren't with us back at that time in 2007. So having said that, give it a chance, check it out, and support Martin. Go track down his books. They're a good read, always. And we should get an update from Martin Popoff, get him back on the podcast sometime soon. He's been on two or three times, and he's always been a great one to chat to. So with that said, let's check out a little classic Sabbath. We'll listen to my chat with Martin, then we'll end with a little sound sample of Dio-era Sabbath, a little TV Crimes. Anyways, let's get into a little Sabbath. This is A National Acrobat, and it'll be followed by Martin Popoff and myself talking about Black Sabbath. I am the world. Hey, this is Mark Striegel of the Talking Metal Podcast, and we are very excited because on the line with us, we have Martin Popoff. How you doing, Martin?
Doing just fine there, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. I'm a big fan of your writing, your magazine, your website. I am just finishing up reading the Black Sabbath book that you wrote, Doom Let Loose, and
cool,
it is
cool.
An amazing read, and wanted to talk to you about that, and then also, you know, talk to you about the website, some of your other books, and just talk some metal with you in general.
Sure, sounds good.
So, Martin, how did you compile the information for this book? I mean, it's so detailed, it's so in-depth that, I mean, I was just thinking you must have done hours and hours of interviews and months of research.
Well, I don't know. Not really. I don't know. Basically, all these bio-type books that I've done are more or less the same. Now, this one did get a little extra attention. I actually had an editor on it and stuff like that. And, you know, we obviously got a lot of photos and graphics and things. But really, I only decide to do one of these books if I have a huge backlog of my own interviews with these guys.
Right.
And with Sabbath, I have talked to, you know, various members, probably added up, it's probably 30 or 40 interviews.
Wow.
You know, given how many people have gone through that band. So I had lots of interviews. I had a lot of my own stuff. So that gives you the basis of saying, right, well, I've got something here and a whole bunch of this will be exclusive at least. And then, you know, I just pick up other press just like other people do, go through my old Circus and Cream magazines and Hit Paraders and stuff like that and find a few quotes here and there that make sense. But yeah, you know, and at one point you kind of get thinking, okay, I might do a book on this band one day. So the next time I talk to them about something, I'll hit them with a few extra old questions until I've kind of worn out my welcome on that or whatever, or ran out of time. So, you know, it really wasn't that much work, or you know, probably just like anything, you just go and forget how much work it was.
Right. Now, right off the bat, I'd like to mention that this book, the best place to get it is probably your website, right? MartinPopoff.com?
Well, this particular book has really good distribution. I mean, it's probably everywhere. It's at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders and all that. But my site, I do buy a supply of all my books, and then, you know, I sign them and sell them one at a time, mail order kind of thing. And I do have it at my site. And a whole lot of my other books, I think I have the last copies of many of them. And then we've done a bunch of books through Metal Blade as well, where those are really not available in too many places. And again, yeah, any of my books that are available anywhere, I at least have some of them. But yeah, there are even some that are right out of print that I don't even have.
Cool. And like you mentioned, one cool thing that I have in my book is that you signed it, and that's because it was bought through your site.
Yeah,
and
sure.
So talking about Black Sabbath, going back to the very beginning, one thing that, you know, there's so much in this book, and there's so much great stuff that's written, and we'll only have time to probably, you know, talk about certain things. But one of the things I really like that you show is how important each individual member of the original Black Sabbath was to Sabbath's sound and success. It wasn't just Tony's riffs or Ozzy's voice, but there were a real team.
For sure. And I've always felt that, I mean, of course, okay, number one, there is Tony. He's the riff master. He's the inventor of heavy metal, for sure. There's Ozzy and his personality and his likability and his voice, definitely. But, yeah, this is kind of a strange band because the bass player wrote all the lyrics. So you've got Geezer there writing all the lyrics. And, man, you know, based on the solo material, I just think Bill Ward's like the genius of the band that is totally unheralded. He's like the John Paul Jones of Led Zeppelin, the quiet guy who is just so musical, or at least proven in later years through like that Ward One Along the Way and When the Bow Breaks, how amazing he is just as a writer. So, yeah, and as a drummer, he's a totally, totally unique drummer. And, of course, he was in on some of the writing as you go along. But, yeah, you're right. That's an interesting point. I mean, there were no slackers in the band, although as drugs and drink took over, you know, everybody seemed to want to slack,
right?
You know, at various points, and that caused a lot of tension with these guys.
Well, the one thing I did not know, which I learned from your book, was how involved, like, Bill was, you know, with kind of even watching over the money at one point and taking on manager-type roles.
Yeah, or trying to, and you even get a sense from Bill when you talk to him. I mean, he's one of the coolest guys to interview. He's just this really polite and soft-spoken, but he always has insightful things to say. You know, he's almost like the psyche of the band. You know, he kind of keeps everybody in line or reads everybody properly, where, you know, someone like Geezer or Tony, I think they're a little quieter and just don't let their feelings out or even let information out as much as someone like Bill would. And same with Ozzy. I mean, Bill was really the guy who probably held the whole thing together.
Definitely, definitely. Now, going to the actual records, I know, you know, there are so many Black Sabbath records that, you know, we won't talk about each and every one of them, but I wanted to touch upon, let's start off with maybe some of your favorites, Masters of Reality.
Yeah, Master of Reality I thought was an amazing album, simply because the production on it is just insane. It's just so loud and bass heavy and guitar heavy, and that, you know, the heavy songs in that are just the classics. I mean, I'm really not a big fan of the first or the second album as much, and really the second album is probably just because I'm sick of it more than anything, because that's where a lot of the big hits came from. But Master of Reality is just this big, warm, bulldozing, heavy album, and definitely, given its age, it's one of the handful of records that invented metal, for sure.
Definitely. And that, of course, was their third record. And you mentioned their first and second record. I mean, the second record, it is nowadays, you know, very tough to listen to those songs over and over again. But yet it still seems like it's the one record that the general public point to as, you know, the definitive Sabbath record, with War Pigs and Paranoid.
Yeah, which is just, you know, the stupidity and the sheep mentality of large crowds at work there, really. I mean, it's almost like every band, they have one record that everybody's got to own, and then a whole segment of fans can just drop off at that point. And, you know, Sabbath is partly to blame as well by just playing those songs endlessly over and over and over again, because basically Ozzy's comfortable with them.
Right.
But, you know, Iron Man, I've read a lot of things, and it really makes sense that when people say that, okay, the vocal melody of this, there isn't one. It goes along with the riff. It's boring. It's just this, you know, it's really pretty rudimentary heavy metal. So when that's your biggest song, and Paranoid as well, which was written just like on the back of an envelope at the end of the session, you know, this little 2-minute blast, these are actually two of their probably least considered and quickest written songs, I would imagine. And they're really not that sophisticated or great, yet they are the calling cards of the band. So I wouldn't doubt it if those songs actually even hurt their reputation a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I read an interview with somebody somewhere, and they were talking about how college marching bands now, you know, in the Midwest are playing Iron Man as part of their repertoire.
Nice.
But moving on, Volume 4, which you weren't quite as excited about. It's one of my favorite Black Sabbath records, but what didn't work quite as well on Volume 4 for you?
I don't know. It's like this dark horse album of the classic, you know, beginning eight. It's the one that people kind of least know. You know, they didn't play a lot of it live. I found the arrangements or maybe the sound or something, it just all had the same sort of churn throughout. I don't know if I could say much more than that. Yeah. Definitely it was pretty cool, and it was definitely one of the first ones I ever got. But, you know, to me, I like the dimensionality of the next bunch that come after that.
Yeah, of course, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath being next, and that it sounds so drastically different than Volume 4, and it's something you talk about in the book, that they really had kind of hit their mark at this point, just with production and songwriting.
Yeah, you know, they do, you know, they've said in interviews, and it's so funny to read back at those old interviews, that, oh, we like nice songs. We like, you know, we want to do something commercial. We don't want to just hit ourselves over the head all the time, when really the soft songs or the soft moments on that are bleak and not commercial and probably even scarier than all their heavy stuff. So it's kind of interesting that way. I mean, they hit their stride, but one wonders if it's a lot of booze and drugs that is helping, you know, those next two records be so insanely creative as they are. I mean, there's just so much going on them, and so many avenues tried, that it's really like that you know, intense creativity that you saw out of some of the greatest, most intense creative 70s bands, which would be maybe Zeppelin or Queen. And basically those two records are like Zeppelin or Queen records, or say, you know, Sin After Sin or Stained Glass as well.
Definitely.
That kind of thing.
And the cool thing about the book, again, which is Black Sabbath, Doom Let Loose, highly recommended for all the Talking Metal listeners, you get all sorts of cool little tidbits, like, for example, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, you mentioned Rick Wakeman from Yes is on that record.
Yeah, and I eventually talked to Rick a couple years ago, and we talked about that. But yeah, this happened with these bands a lot of times. It's like whoever's in the studio next door with you or whatever, you're all kind of buddies. You just call somebody in, hey, would you like to, you know, blow a part on this? And that happens. So, and Rick, you know, he looks like this scary guy, and his long straight hair and his big robes, you'd think he would be kind of really antisocial or whatever. He's like just a totally normal, grounded, fun-loving guy.
Wow.
that really probably just fit right into Sabbath. And I think, I'm not sure if I said this in the book or whatever, but I just recall people saying that he actually, you know, had more fun with Sabbath than he had with Yes.
Yeah, you do mention that in the book, okay, that he hangs out at the bar with Sabbath, and
yeah.
I guess Yes was recording either down the street or in the same studio as them.
Yeah, it must have been. Yeah, yeah, and that would have been, so 73. That would have been something like, Tales of Topographic was 74. It could have been that. I'm not sure what they had as a 73 album, but maybe close to the edge of 71. Yeah. I guess he was just around. Might even been doing solo albums by then.
Right. And the song "Who Are You" from Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, that's, you know, something I didn't know. That's all Ozzy, right?
Yeah, which is kind of a cool story. I mean, Ozzy just did not do a lot of writing. I think he probably felt pretty insecure about it. It sounded like I got the impression that Geezer felt that way later too. Everybody felt insecure bringing their songs to each other because they were such a highly evolved unit together that it sounds like there was no pussyfooting around. It was just like, you would just get slagged if they didn't like your songs. And probably like a gang mentality, they would gang up on you. And then I remember Geezer saying at one point, it made you not want to bring your stuff in.
Right.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the next album, which has been one that I've heard Ozzy and I think even Tony say negative things about in the press, Sabotage.
Yeah, I think those guys just say that kind of stuff more so because they remember what hell it was recording it because they were going through all those legal woes. But, you know, a lot of Sabbath fans and a lot of, you know, serious Sabbath students of the band love that album. And I'd say it's my favorite Sabbath album. And I've always argued that it's probably one of my favorite albums of all time. You know, I usually put in there Led Zeppelin, Physical Graffiti, even Clash London Calling.
Sure.
You know, I put in Queen One, I put in Dictator's Blood Brothers, you know, all those sorts of albums. But, you know, I always make the comment too that you know, Sabotage and Physical Graffiti came out at the same time, and Sabotage covered as much ground and did as well with one record.
And I mean, Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath and Sabotage, for me personally, I mean, Ozzy has never sounded better on those records. His voice just sounds great. And I see in the book, you mentioned that one of the reasons they didn't play a lot of material off those records live was he had trouble repeating those live.
Exactly,
those notes.
Yeah, and you know, you listen back to them and you're right. I mean, Ozzy is just screeching and wailing and singing really strong and really high. And I guess you take that into a live environment, you can sort of forget it. And I think on some of those Castle reissues, whatever that live album was called, you got Megalomania and maybe Symptom of the Universe, a couple of those, and you can hear, it's quite a strain.
Yeah, definitely. And I know when they did Sabbath, Bloody Sabbath, I think on the reunion tour, but it was like he was singing it an octave lower or something.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I remember that. Yeah.
So kind of jumping ahead, Ronnie James Dio and enters the band at kind of an interesting time. Ozzy is gone, and not only is Ozzy gone, one thing I didn't realize that Bill Ward was gone and Geezer was gone too, and it was basically, according to your book, Ronnie and Tony just started working on stuff without those guys, and I guess they kind of filtered back into the band eventually.
Yeah, and then, you know, the thing that a lot of people don't remember or realize, on the tour of Heaven and Hell, Bill was gone. I mean, he did a little bit of the first tour, so it was Vinny in there. So when people are talking about this Heaven and Hell band up now, you know, it really is Vinny's situation and not Bill's situation, and that's probably why Bill isn't in there. So he didn't last very long in this situation. But yeah, it could have turned into something completely different. And, you know, there's a tantalizing little bit about how some of that music might have even been worked out up by Ozzy a little bit before he left, which is kind of neat. Just like the whole are there tapes with Bon Scott singing any Back in Black songs?
Right.
Controversy, right?
Yeah. Well, and that reminds me of something you mentioned in the book, the rumor of the Led Zeppelin Black Sabbath jam that was maybe recorded but probably not recorded.
Yeah. That all started because I had it from good sources. One of my publishers who kind of knows a lot of this circle of people, I think he was actually in a room. I'm not sure. I might have explained this in fairly good depth there, but maybe not. But he was actually in a room where he pointed to the corner and said, "What's that, Black Zeppelin?" And the guy said, "Oh, yeah, those are just some tapes that we did a long time ago with, you know, when they swapped singers and went down the road and did some songs together." So it actually all started from that. So that to me sounds pretty concrete. And then, of course, shortly after that, any time I would talk to a Black Sabbath member, I'd ask them about it, and they'd all say, yeah, we did that, but I don't think we recorded any of it.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly how you describe it in the book. I mean,
yeah.
It would be something if those ever do come about and materialize.
Yeah, that would be cool. I mean, you know, the other thing that is just kind of a drag is that there really aren't any Sabbath rarities, or very, very few. And it amounts to nothing. I mean, the coolest rarities there are really in this entire story of Black Sabbath are the two or three Ian Gillan era Born Again songs that are basically truly finished off and sound great.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, there's no old Ozzy, there's no old Dio stuff. So it's kind of a drag. These guys just did not have, you know, demos and unreleased tracks to throw around.
Right. Right. Well, back to Mob Rules, Vinny Appice. One thing, again, the book is loaded with so many cool little facts. I never realized the Vinny Appice, John Lennon connection. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Sure. I kind of barely remember it, but tell me if I'm getting this right. Yeah, they were next door or something working on, was he working on his Axis or Circus or Bruiser album? I can't remember, but for some reason, the reason I get this screwed up is because I also had talked to Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick about this, and he was in on some of those sessions as well. And I can't remember if he even knows if the stuff was used or not, but Vinny was basically around, and John Lennon would come in and listen, and they'd smoke a bit of pot, and he went in, and I think Vinny says in there that he ended up doing some hand claps.
Right, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that the Double Fantasy album, or was that something earlier?
I think that's the Double Fantasy album. I'm not a John Lennon expert, but I think you said Whatever Gets Me Through the Night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll check that. I'll have to.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. But yeah, that was his, you know, talking to Vinny, he just goes back and looks at his career and he just marvels, wow, this was so cool. Smoking pot with John Lennon, you know?
And didn't they actually record some of Mob Rules, or at least write some of Mob Rules, in a house that Ringo owned that once belonged to John Lennon?
Yeah, the same way that British Steel was done there. But with Sabbath, again, my memory here again, I believe how it worked was that the first version of Mob Rules that was used on the heavy metal soundtrack was done at Ringo's studio, Startling Studios or Starling Studios or whatever it's called.
Right.
So the first version, which is totally a different recording than the version that's on the album, was done for the heavy metal, that double album and that movie that came out. You know, with much hype, it's got a Sammy Hagar song on there, a non-LP Nazareth song, a Riggs song. But Sabbath did Mob Rules for that, and it was one of the most famous songs on it. And then the crazy, crazy thing is that years later, the same thing happened with Dehumanizer with TV Crimes, right?
Right, that was on, what, the Heavy Metal 2 soundtrack or something?
No, that was on Wayne's World or something.
Oh, okay.
But,
okay.
Again, a version was recorded for a movie, and then they recorded another version that went on the album, so it's the exact parallel situation happened again to those guys.
Very cool. And the mighty Ian Gillan joining forces with the guys. You want to talk about how that came about?
Well, there's conflicting stories, but it sounded like it was all, you know, the subject of a meeting at the pub, and that's where they all got together, but the management, you know, might have got involved before. But, you know, I guess there was just a mutual admiration there, and so they got together and made that record that a lot of people really, really like, and a lot of people hate, and a lot of people discuss the production, which, you know, most of the band figures is completely botched. But, you know, I always liked the production, and I thought it was bizarre, you know, eccentric, but cool. And it's a very heavy album. And I just think Ian Gillan's great. I mean, I literally, you know, sometimes I tell people, like, the band Gillan is my favorite band of all time because they made these five or six albums that are all great.
Right.
You know, and I told Ian that, and I think he thought I was just pulling his leg. You know, he kind of cracked a smile. It's like, yeah, sure you do. But it's true. I mean, that band is amazing. So I love Ian, you know, as a writer, as a person, he's really cool. And it's just great that he got in there and gave Sabbath that really weird twist for one record.
Yeah, Born Again, one of my favorite Sabbath records. We actually had him on the podcast back last year, and he was one of the most down-to-earth guys I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with.
Yeah, pretty cool guy, for sure.
Very nice guy. And he actually, on his recent record, redid Trashed.
Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Yeah, on Gillan's Inn. Although he didn't play that when I saw the show for that tour.
Oh, no?
Unfortunately, no. Played a lot of really weird stuff, but yeah, that was definitely a cool Sabbath album.
Cool. Well, we'll wrap up the Sabbath stuff and kind of get into some of your other stuff, but any thoughts on the future of Black Sabbath? We have, of course, the Heaven and Hell tour, which is going to be coming out, which personally, for me, being 37, I discovered Sabbath right around Mob Rules, and Dio was the singer then, so I have a little bit of a problem that they're not calling this Black Sabbath. Any reason why they wouldn't?
Well, first of all, Mob Rules was the first time I ever saw Sabbath, too. I mean, that was my first tour. I saw them in Vancouver with the Outlaws backing up. So, yeah, I have fond memories of that whole thing, too. I've actually now interviewed all four of the guys about Heaven and Hell because I'm doing the cover story for our next issue of Brave Words and Bloody Knuckles on it. And I've actually asked all four of them that question. And the answer is a little bit vague, but it kind of makes sense. And I even posited this with Ronnie, and I said, Ronnie, do you think, you've all given me this weird answer, but do you think it might be a little bit of heading off at the pass, appeasing Sharon even before you upset Sharon about this being Black Sabbath, and, saying, we're going to call it something else even before she asks you to call it something else kind of thing. And he said, yeah, there might be a bit of that, might be a bit of truth to that. But, Sharon has been to Tony's house for dinner. They had a meeting in London. Sharon, Ronnie's quote said, he said, Sharon said, well, you guys got to make a living. You can go do this. So it doesn't sound like there's really any hard feelings about it. Now, the reason given is that they don't want confusion. The Black Sabbath that went into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is the one with Ozzy, blah, blah, blah. What Ronnie said, actually, which is kind of maybe new news for the first time, because I haven't certainly posted this anywhere, but we saw Sharon's, fairly innocuous quote about, there might be an Ozzy, there's going to be an Ozzy, a tour with Ozzy and an album with Ozzy, and everybody just rolls their eyes and says, yeah, sure. But Ronnie actually seemed a little bit more sure that Sabbath will do a 40th anniversary tour with Ozzy. He seemed like that was really, truly likely going to happen. But the commitment, I've heard from two of the guys, the commitment of this thing is a full year. So this is a long, long time that they're doing all this. On the name, they just kind of wanted something different to demarcate it. And, I my instant gut reaction was I kind of liked the idea because it almost gave a little, shot of adrenaline to the thing.
Right.
Just seeing that up there, it's almost like this is a fresh band. It's almost like it takes 4 or 5 years off their lives, by giving it a new name. It's like, and it makes them look a little bit more like renegades, firing on all sixes, no weak links here kind of thing. That's really it. And when it comes down to it, it really doesn't matter. Everybody knows what it is anyways. There's not going to be any confusion. Fans who know this stuff aren't going to have the band come through town and miss them because they didn't notice that it was Black Sabbath or anything like that.
Right, and there will be 3 new songs I read on bravewords.com, right?
Yeah, and I've talked to all the guys about those, and basically, well, really only Ronnie or Tony said anything interesting. Ronnie mentioned the whole thing, he went through the whole thing of all the lyrics, and all three of them sound super interesting.
Wow, cool.
Just really, really cool lyrics that they've done for these things.
Now, you have a lot of other great books. Now, as a kid growing up, I used to just put on the Iron Maiden record and just zone out into the artwork of Derek Riggs. And I was excited because for Christmas, my wife gave me Run for Cover.
Cool.
How did you decide to put that together?
Well, a fan in Chicago really started this up as quite a bit of an altruistic kind of thing. He wanted to help Derek out and help him make some money, and he came up with the whole idea. He put the whole project together. He had a bunch of my books. He called me up and said, do you want to write this? And I said, sure. And him and I went down and visited Derek for 3 days over a weekend, and I did a bunch of interviews, and I did a bunch of phone interviews with him as well. And, he dealt with Derek on getting all the artwork, and he had a lot of his own artwork. He actually collects some original heavy metal artwork. He's got some really cool stuff. But he gathered all the images and set up the layout at his hometown, Chicago, and the people who did the design of the book had it printed in China, and that's how it happened. And there was a hardcover first edition that's all sold out, and a lot of soft covers, and that's where it stands. 9x12 book, full color throughout, basically a coffee table book, and it all got pulled off. It all worked.
Great. Well, I'm looking forward to reading that one. And you have a book about Dio?
Yeah, a Dio book came out a little while ago, and a rainbow book. And it was funny getting Ronnie on the phone again. You wonder if the guy thinks you're stalking him doing these three books on him.
Right,
like that.
Right.
And really, they were all in pretty quick succession. And right now, basically, I've got that series of this, The Collector's Guide to Heavy Metal, Volume 1, the 70s, Volume 2, the 80s, came out in 05. 70s was in 03, and I'm hard at work on getting 90s done for later this year.
Oh, great. I'm a big fan of Volume 2, the one,
oh, cool,
the 80s one, yeah.
Yeah, and so 90s is getting done. It's going to be about as long as the 80s, maybe even a little longer, and then I'm done. I'm handing the franchise over to one of the writers for our magazine, David Perry, who basically I said, start writing, start keeping the stuff, start keeping it in order, because I am not doing the 2000s. I'm done. I'm too old.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, just to give a plug out to bravewords.com. Now,
yeah,
you set this website up on your own, or was there a team of guys who put it together?
I'm actually very minor in the whole thing. The boss of the magazine is Tim Henderson, and it's his vision. And the guy who lays out our magazine, Hugh LaFlamme, and his brother Blaze, do a lot of the computery work on it. And basically, Tim is the guy driving it. He does a lot of the grabbing of the news and news posts, and he's got an employee at the office, and a couple of our other writers work around the clock. One guy in Germany does the late-night stuff for us here. I edit, I write reviews, I send stuff in, the stories I edit, they go in, but basically Tim is just driven to make that thing, you know, people call us the CNN of the CNN of metal news kind of thing, and we do a really good job of, you know, there's a new news item up there every 10 minutes or few minutes or something like that, and it gets a lot of traffic, and it does well. I mean, I actually use it myself to check out the metal news.
Yeah, it's definitely on my favorites. It is also linked through talkingmetal.com in our links section. So all you guys should definitely check out bravewords.com and add that to your favorites. It's every morning when I get to work, first place I go.
Yeah, it's a big part of the magazine now, and really in a lot of ways it has more power and reaches more people than probably even the magazine. But the two work together. And, you know, when we get interviews now, we sometimes say, well, we'll throw one to the site and we'll throw one to the magazine kind of thing. So we often ask for two interviews. And the board, the Brave Board, as they call it, is totally, totally, you know, hopping. I mean, there is so many people just discussing metal. There's a new thread there up every few minutes kind of thing, it seems.
Cool. I mean, it's amazing how the online metal community has kind of come together in this this new technology and everything.
For sure.
The actual magazine, we usually get it down here in New York. It seems like about a week or so after I see it up on the website.
Right.
But it is always worth going to get, and the pictures are always great. In issue 101, I know you have a couple stories. Crocus. What's going on with Crocus?
That was funny. They've got a new album, but it's pretty low-key. I mean, I think it's a pretty good album, but a lot of our writers kind of trashed it. And it really is just Mark and a bunch of guys now. Mark is really running the show. But I love Mark. I really like that band. I have a lot of fond memories to listen to them as a kid. I hope they come over here. I would love to get all my vinyl signed.
Definitely.
It'd be cool. But no, 102's, I'm going to have like a 3-4-page thing on this whole Heaven and Hell thing. That's going to be the cover story.
Cool. Well, we will be waiting for that. You also cover Lamb of God in the issue 101, which is one of my favorite new bands. We actually had Mark Morton on the podcast a couple months ago.
Cool. Excellent. Yeah, Mark's a nice guy.
Yeah, and great new band. So definitely check that out. And let's end today's interview going back to your book, The Guide to Heavy Metal, Volume 2, the 80s. And if you don't mind, I'd love to read down your top 10 heavy metal records from the 80s, and you're welcome to give a little comment on each one.
Cool,
if you'd
I'd like to hear what they are. I can't remember.
You can't remember. Okay. Well, it's a great list. I'll tell you that. Number 10, Iron Maiden, Peace of Mind.
Yeah, that's my favorite Maiden album. That was really the last one that had the full-on magic for me. I mean, it literally started sliding with the next one, Power Slave. I mean, I love Power Slave, and I was totally into it and totally into metal then, but Peace of Mind is just such a solid, you know, distinct piece of work, great drumming, just everything about that album. It's paced well, it's sequenced well, great album.
Yeah, definitely. And it felt like kind of like with Power Slave, they started to get away from what they were on those first four records, which was mm-hmm. just an amazing heavy metal band.
Yeah.
Although they still are an amazing heavy metal band. I mean, I love the newest record.
Mm-hmm.
Flick of the Switch, AC/DC.
Yeah, you know, Tim and I always talk, Tim from the magazine, we both agree that's the greatest AC/DC album, and very few people pick that. It's the heaviest one, I bet. I really think it's the heaviest one they ever did. And this seems like such a weird thing to say, but I think they basically got that lineup right after three albums of trying. And that album is so electric and so dense and just so powerful. You know, the one before it is a little bit bluesy and warm. Back in Black, of course, it's a classic, but again, it's a little all over the place. I just think Flick of the Switch is just relentless, perfect AC/DC.
Very cool. No Place to Run, UFO.
Yeah, and again, another strange choice. I mean, I really like the Paul Chapman era over a lot of the Michael Schenker era, actually.
Wow.
You know, when it comes to the percentages, because I think a lot of those Michael Schenker albums are just like the production's a little bit gray and boring. You know, the early stuff's a little eccentric, but the Paul Chapman stuff, and that one in particular, and that one was produced by George Martin of Beatles fame, which is kind of neat.
Yeah, that is neat. Cool. Checking in at 7, a little Sabotage.
Yeah. What did I put? The first album?
Sirens.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. When we got that album, I remember looking at the indie version of that album when I first saw it in the store and picking it up and going, what the hell is this? You know, it's like, you know, with the old cover, right, on Par Records, the old, you know, the blue ship cover and all that. I flip it over and I look, well, they do have a song called Twisted Little Sister, so that must be a Twisted Sister reference, so this must be heavy metal, and it does say the drummer plays cannons or something like that, so I suppose it's going to be metal, and I remember getting it home thinking, this is the greatest album I've ever heard. You know, the production, just the playing, the singing, everything about that record was almost like a new state of the art.
Cool, and number 6, not Moving Pictures, but Signals, Rush.
Yeah, another weird choice because that was the first pronounced, drop down from the electric guitars. But I just think that album has just got this creamy sound and it's just so unified and so sophisticated. I just found it just really, really professional and studied and considered. I just think there's just a lot of neat variety on that record and it took a lot of bravery to do something like that.
And at number 5, you chose Thin Lizzy. A lot of people remember Thin Lizzy as more of a 70s band, but they did have a couple great records in the 1980s. Renegade is what you chose for number 5. I love Thunder and Lightning, too. That's an amazing record.
Yeah, although that is just so harsh on the production, I have a hard time. And the other thing about Thin Lizzy that I've always found interesting, I remember reading once where they almost didn't want to put Angel of Death on Renegade because they thought it was too cheesy heavy metal. Well, I think there's 3 or 4 songs on Thunder and Lightning that are just too heavy metal as well.
Right.
This band is almost like above heavy metal. They're just too sophisticated. And Renegade is a funny choice. Some people do like it. There's a small number of fans that like it. I mean, it is a little mellower, but I just love the smooth, plush production and the playing. I just find it like a really aristocratic sort of album.
Definitely. And Dio, last in line at number 4.
Yeah, that was my favorite Dio album. It's very similar to the first album, but I found that one just a little more note dense and sophisticated, and it just hit me at the right time in my youth kind of thing. Just great, fast songs on it, great solos. I just thought it was an improvement on Holy Diver, which was a great album, but maybe just a little bit cruder. But then Last in Line was just a little bit more considered, studied.
Yeah, definitely. Grim Reaper, See You in Hell at number 3.
That's pretty bizarre. Yeah. I put that on my list for sure somewhere in the top 20 or whatever, but to see I put it at number 3, that's pretty funny. That was just a really magical, scary, interesting album with a lot of mystical, enigmatic quality to it from the new wave of British heavy metal. It was crude. It was kind of, it seemed like it sped up and slowed down. It was, the production was bizarre, but cool. Very, very electric. Great singing. Just great, great songs and not very flashy playing or anything like that. Just a real, real personable new wave of British heavy metal album.
Cool. And at number 2, not Master of Puppets, but Ride the Lightning.
Definitely. I always thought that Master of Puppets, when I got that, this is basically they're retreading Ride the Lightning. Although, great album, and I have another book called The Top 500 Heavy Metal Albums of All Time, which is sadly sold out. I wish I could get some of them. But we took a huge, huge poll of all sorts of people, and that actually won. Master of Puppets won Greatest Heavy Metal Album of All Time for that book. But to me, Ride the Lightning, I remember getting that home, and I think the story is somewhere, but I either brought that home the same time as both Sabotage Sirens and Savage, Loose, and Lethal, or maybe just one of them, but I remember dropping the needle, starting off Fight Fire with Fire and that acoustic intro, and then when that kicks in, that absolutely, basically they tore up the rule book and whacked the next level up on the old Richter scale. Nothing was ever that heavy before. Production-wise, playing, sophistication, it was just, that album, the fast, the slow, the instrumental, everything about it is just absolutely perfect to me.
Yeah, I remember the same thing, getting that record home, and I hadn't had Kill 'Em All. That was the first exposure I had to Metallica, and just being blown away by Fight Fire with Fire.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And, Kill 'Em All, we had that album right when it came out, and we played it, and we thought Metallica, great band, one of our favorite bands, great, great new band, these guys are going places. But really, Kill 'Em All is not that sophisticated an album. What they do, what's so great about it is they come up with like about 15 of the greatest, most immediate, excellent heavy metal riffs of all time. But then that's all it is. They just hammer you with those riffs. There's just really nothing all that sophisticated about Kill 'Em All, great album as it is.
Right, definitely. And at number 1, Accept, Balls to the Wall.
That's a funny choice too. Again, that would maybe make my top 15 or whatever, but all those obviously could be jumbled around. But that record, I do recall, when people ask you what are your favorite records, and sometimes you offer a bit of a, I better answer this properly so nobody thinks I'm an idiot,
right?
And and thinks I'm not cool. But then you stand back and go, well, if I answer this truthfully, one of the big ways of doing it should be, what did I just play to death over and over and over again? Maybe that should be the criteria. And that album I played to death over and over and over again. I just thought it was so classy how it was understated and subdued and didn't go too fast, and the production was really conservative, and they repeated the riffs over and over, and I just found that record just had so much personality to it, even though Restless and Wild might be the flashier album, the cruder, the faster album, the more wild heavy metal album. To me, this was just like a really, really cool, sophisticated, great, great example of great songwriting.
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, that's a lot of it too, is where you were in your life when you experienced music.
Yeah,
I think that makes it so great to each and every one of us.
God, what are 5 of yours?
Oh, 5 of mine. I think I would go with, I like Master of Puppets a lot. I have to say that's probably one of my favorites. I don't know if we're just talking 80s right now, but Let There Be Rock, which is 70s, is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah.
I like a lot of the Judas Priest stuff, Screaming for Vengeance, which I noticed, is that even in your top 100?
I have some big problems with that album, and those big problems are Take These Chains, You Got Another Thing Coming, Devil's Child, and Fever. And when you pick 4 songs off an album with 9 songs on it or whatever it is, maybe it's even 8 songs if you don't count Hellion, like, you don't like that album very much. So I do have a problem with that album. But Judas Priest, to me, actually probably did more for heavy metal than anybody on this planet, because when you look at the run from Sad Wings through Sin After Sin, Stained Glass, and Hellbent for Leather, Hellbent for Leather actually is one of my favorite albums of all time. When you take those four, I mean, those guys are gods to me forever. Basically, for me, it started getting dumbed down when Dave Holland joined the band. So, no, I couldn't put that up there because there's four Kiss songs on it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Some of my other favorites, of course, the Zeppelin stuff. I like Heaven and Hell, one of my definitely favorite records.
Yeah, for sure. And Ronnie's favorite record he's ever done.
Yeah, I read that actually in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a lot of good stuff, and everybody has their favorites. And
what's your Zeppelin picks?
My Zeppelin picks, I like Zeppelin II a lot, and that might be partly just because of how I was exposed to it. And I know Zeppelin IV is not a cool thing to say, but it just in sixth grade when I discovered it, it just like opened up my ears to a whole new world.
Yeah,
cool. I'm a big Kiss fan. I like Kiss Alive.
Yeah. That made a lot. That was a huge record for me too.
I mean, that was I think my first record I ever had on vinyl.
Cool.
Well,
you got in pretty early then, eh?
Yeah, I guess I got in, you know, and it was Kiss because they were such a comic book type of band that, you know, I saw them on the Paul Lynn Halloween special.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I saw that, yeah.
You know, I was hooked as a real little kid, you know.
Yeah.
And
our funny Kiss Alive story, maybe you might have read this somewhere because I think I stuck it in a book or two, but we had gone to the city dump. You know, I grew up in a town of about 10,000 people, right? And, you know,
right.
You're just little kids. You go to the dump. You're just looking for crap or whatever. You're just, I don't know what you're doing. But anyway, so we go to the dump, and there's this big pile of pristine, you know, it must have been like a 4-inch stack of untouched April Wine 1974 tour posters.
Oh, wow.
And they're all like purple and black psychedelic. So we had one of our little elementary school dances planned, and we took those posters and put them all around every single wall of our basement rec room from ceiling to floor, cutting out for the light switch, all that, right?
Yeah.
Just made this room look wild. So we had everybody over, and then, you know, we had this little dance going, and you know, the girls all want to hear Elton John, and we're playing, slipping as much heavy stuff as we could. And we're all in like grade 5 or something like this, right? And one of our buddies shows up late, and he brings Kiss Alive. And there was this huge dog pile, like, on top of him, and he's holding the album out, you know, so it doesn't get ruined. And we're all just, like, on top of him. And that was the end of the dance. It was like, just, okay, Kiss Alive for the whole rest of the day.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it's funny.
Very funny. A couple others I'm just thinking of. Queensryche, yeah. Operation Mindcrime. What do you think of Queensryche?
You know, I only bought into Queensryche in a big, big way for like The Warning. I remember I was still playing drums and trying to be a good drummer, and that was a big, big heavy metal year for me, 1984. I was just so into metal, even though I was 21 years old by that point. But that was a huge, huge metal time, and I loved The Warning, and then it just kind of faded a little over the years. Obviously, that's a great pick. Everybody loves that album. You got great taste, of course, picking that.
Well, thanks.
But, I was just never got into Queensryche after that record for some reason.
Cool. Well, Guns N' Roses, I think Appetite for Destruction, for me personally, was a real important record. What is your opinion on Guns?
For Guns, I'm a very contrarian Guns fan. I never thought that record was that much of a big deal, and really no one did it for about a year and a half until it really started breaking. But I do like Guns a lot, but it's not really for that reason. I really like Illusion 1 and 2. I love those two records together. I got into the huge hype around it when they were coming out, and the fact that it was this double and stuffed full of songs, and I really got into Guns right around that time. But You know, I always say my favorite band that is like Guns N' Roses that should have been bigger than Guns N' Roses is Love Hate.
Love Hate, sure.
Oh God, those
Jizzy Pearl,
albums,
right?
Yeah, that second album is one of my favorite albums of all time, Wasted in America. Just so nasty yet sophisticated. It's just a really, really cool album, and that's the kind of band. Granted, it's like 5 years later. I mean,
yeah.
you can't even compare. But I just thought there were other bands just as good as Guns N' Roses that maybe could have been that big.
Cool. Well, fair enough. And thanks again so much, Martin, for coming on the podcast
today.
Hey,
thanks for having me. This is fun.
Yeah, definitely I mean, fun. That's what we do here. We talk metal, and it's a lot of fun. And you're welcome back anytime. And we encourage all our listeners, again, to go to the bookstore and pick up your books. They're all a great read, and your personality comes through in all of them, which I think is important.
Yeah, people can email me. I'll answer all questions, whatever, you know. That's cool.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Martin, and we will talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me again.
Know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.